I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for tonight, and that's Dave.
Hi, my name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. Fix the microphone. I'll start where I started drinking. I started drinking when I was 13 years old. My progression moved rather quickly. By the time I was 14, I was in my first rehab. It was a 28-day program at Carrier. I had only been drinking 9 or 10 months at that point. And it did include, I am going to steal this from someone here, non-conference approved substances at that age, because alcohol was actually harder to get. At that age, I found myself using more than my friends. I found myself wanting to escape on a daily basis, and my parents had recognized that. And my mother, being in the field she is, she's a learning disability specialist. She special ed teacher as well. She quickly saw that there was a problem with my behavior that I didn't see at all. You know, I thought there was absolutely no problem with drinking and or using on a daily basis at that age. I left Carrier Clinic, and within a week or two, I went to a couple meetings, but within a week or two, I was back full bore. I had found a good source for alcohol. I was working with an older guy. I had a part-time job. I was about 15 now. I had a part-time job at a florist, and he used to supply me with alcohol and other non-conference-approved substances, which were a large part of my story until I get a little older. But alcohol really became very prevalent. It was kind of a double-edged sword with the alcohol, because my father is a recovering alcoholic. And throughout my childhood, I always said, I refuse to be an alcoholic. I refuse to, you know, fall prey to alcohol. And what I did was I went with other things. And they eventually always led back to alcohol, but it was a really strong stand I tried to take against alcohol. I refused to drink alcoholically. I refused to allow myself to even enjoy the comforts of alcohol for a while, and which I found quite nice after some time. I wasn't supposed to be funny. When I was 15, I went to my second rehab. It was out in Pennsylvania. My mom thought, oh, he likes the woods, he likes camping. Let's send him to White Deer Run out in Pennsylvania. And they had a rock climbing wall there. It was more a summer camp than anything. And by that point, I realized that more than get anything out of rehab, I liked to flirt with women in rehab, because they were as sick as I was, and they were attracted to my sickness for some reason. And every time I went to rehab, I ended up with some sick girl that we'd use together afterward, and it just got worse. When I was 16, I went to my third rehab, and it was just a whole nice little series there. I got out of that rehab, and I realized that I had to change something, because I had already been arrested a couple times. I had been kicked out of my house, and I kind of wanted to speak on getting kicked out of my house. Patty, you really rung a bell in my head. When I was using and drinking in my house, my parents would lay down the line. They'd say, look, you need to either, you know, stop your behaviors or get out. And I was like, I'll leave. You know, who cares if I have to sleep under a bridge? I can get screwed up. I had no consideration for living in a house with a bed and a sink and toilet. I'd much rather poop 10 feet away from where I'm sleeping in the bushes and be able to get high and drunk. And I was much happier. The sickness of that only became clear to me a lot later. But for years, you know, I'd move back home. Yeah, I'm not going to do anything. I'll stay sober, la la la. And within a month or two, you know, I was sneaking it. And then a couple months later, 6 months, a year, whatever the case may be, I was out on the street again. And, you know, no place to live, living in my car when I was a little older, whatever the situation. And I would rather be living in my car and drunk than living in a house and sober. The pain was that great. I'm kind of going to jump around a little bit, and I hope it doesn't seem too schizophrenic, but it probably will. When I was very young, I can remember feeling like I wanted to escape. I can always remember that feeling. I used to get very involved in imagination as a little kid, and I think a lot of alcoholics experienced that when they were younger. I used to fib a lot when I was a kid. I used to fib even more when I was older. But when I was a kid, I was always making up these crazy scenarios in my head, and that would allow me to get out of myself for just a little while to alleviate the pain of being me, which is, I think, you know, looking back on it, why I did what I did, you know, why I used alcohol and drugs the way I did. And growing up, I can actually remember my mom saying that. She's like, I go to work all day and I help these kids, but I can't do anything for you. And it didn't click for a long, long time that I had to help myself. You know, that I wasn't going to get help from an external source. I wasn't going to be able to learn this thing and then be better. I wasn't going to be able to go learn about alcoholism or about myself or about depression or whatever the case may be. And I was on, you know, many different medications as a kid. I can remember one time I used to steal my parents' cars when I was about 15. And, you know, my father would leave for work before I went to school, and I, without a license, no insurance, nothing, I'd get into his other car, drive it to school. You know, I was the man driving up to high school at 15 years old in my father's car. One day, I had no idea how to drive a stick shift at all. And one day on the way to school, I rear-ended someone. And I get to school, and I decided to cut school that day. So I went for a drive around, figured, you know, it was done 5 o'clock when he came home. So I just, you know, partied up that day. Bought a half gallon of Jack Daniels and a bottle of sleeping pills. And went back to my house, and I proceeded to drink the Jack Daniels and take the sleeping pills. My thought was, if I die, then I die. But if I don't, I want to know how much I drank to know if I'm alcoholic. Yeah, it was kind of weird. I still think it's kind of weird. It was very, very sick thinking. And what actually happened was my father came home in the nick of time. I was petting an imaginary cat, and then I woke up in the hospital 3 days. 3 days later. And I can remember puking up charcoal. It was a very pleasant experience. And as soon as it was over, I wanted to do it again. I wanted to keep drinking. It was craziness. When I was 16, like I was saying before, I got into the rooms for a little while. I was in the rooms for about 9 months, that stint. It was about 9 years ago when I first started coming around to AA seriously. I found a sponsor. I started to pretend to work the steps, I like to say, because I do the 1-2-3 relapse gig all the time. That was a common reoccurrence for me. The personal inventory was just way too out there for me, and I don't know if I was in enough pain yet, or if I just wasn't old enough, mature enough to understand exactly what it was. But I can remember being told. I asked one guy to sponsor me before I had found my sponsor at that time, and he told me that I was too young to sponsor, and I had to go do more drinking before he could sponsor me. It was good stuff. when I come to AA for those 9 months, I was so proud of myself. I was sober for, you know, a little period of time, and I felt like I got all better. And after, you know, a period of time, I went out and partied with some friends. I can actually remember when I relapsed that time. I was in New York City, and we bought beer illegally in a corner store, a bodega, and proceeded to be the only one that passed out in his own puke that night out of my friends. And it didn't ring any bells. I didn't think anything weird about it. And, you know, I was, I just drank too much that night. It'll be okay. I landed back in AA about a year later. After that, I was 17 and change. And this is actually Mike's favorite part. I was asked to speak, and about 9 or 10 months sober. And I sat down with my big book in this beautiful, dusty church that's in Rocky Hill. Still a meeting that goes there. And the interesting part about that meeting, actually, is I went there as a very young kid with my father. He used to take me to that meeting when I was 4 or 5 years old. And I can remember, you know, hoarding all the cookies and drinking the milk when I was a kid, and then coming back there once I was in the program. It was pretty interesting for me. But I sat down with my big book. I opened it up, and I don't think I'd worked a single step yet. And I proceeded to share on all 12 steps. And I went through each one in great detail, explaining to everyone in the room what they should do to stay sober. And it didn't really do much for anyone. I think it was a waste of time. But what it did teach me is how crazy I was. Because I really thought that I could jive on experiences I hadn't had yet. I really thought that at that time. It was great. I spoke like 1 hour and 10 minutes in an hour meeting. Yeah. It was excellent. And I can actually remember reading my big book while I was speaking. I paused for a few minutes, read it, So, oh, and this is the fifth step. I actually learned some stuff about the steps when I did that. So maybe there was maybe there was something in that in me doing that. But I did not stay sober that time in AA. I relapsed again. I cannot even remember where, when, or how, or why. But I did manage to graduate high school by the skin of my teeth. It took a meeting between my mother, father, and the principal to get me my diploma on time. And I did get it. And I ended up going to community college for a year, where I actually, I don't know how, but I calmed down with the drinking for a while. And I did pretty well in college. I ended up getting accepted to a few universities, and I moved out to Oregon to go to Southern Oregon University. And out there, I really had no holds barred. I was 3,200 miles away from my family and friends. I didn't know anyone. And I got there, and it was just instant go, instant races. And I was going to a university where it's rated like 10th party school in the country, something like that. And it's kind of expected. So I was actually drinking my Snapple bottle before, and I was like, I used to put liquor in these. And I used to take them to class, and I used to get drunk in class. And then I wondered why I got a C in art history, or I'd wonder why I didn't do so well in that class. And I said, oh, because it's 8 o'clock at night, and you were drunk every night. Or I wouldn't show up for class. That was a good one, too. I wouldn't show up for the test, expect to pass. It didn't work, and I could never understand why it wasn't working. I could never understand why my professors just, you know, wouldn't just give me the grades because I was passing the test. I was reading the material. I just was never in class except one, you know, two classes out of a semester. I actually, I did kind of graduate college. I'm still 6 credits shy, but I do have my my degree in political science, useless degree. It is absolutely useless. What I did was I used so much through college that despite being perfectly capable of taking these classes and passing them, I was so focused on getting intoxicated that I couldn't focus on anything else. I was actually I was living in a beautiful house at one point with 3 other roommates. We were all students. Pool, hot tub, sauna, 15 minutes from a ski hill. And I used so much that, and these guys were not mellow guys, and I was using so much in the house that I was asked to leave, and I couldn't understand it. And I said, well, you have to at least give me 60 days. I have a dog. You know, I couldn't understand why they would say, you know, you have 30 days to leave the house. So I got my own place, and that was a real bad move for me because I ended up sitting at home and just getting wrecked every day, every night. And I was actually engaged at the time, and I was kind of living with her, but I was kind of afraid to fully commit to living with her. So, you know, I kept the own place. And as I started using more and more and more, I started living on my own more and more and more. You know, I'd be around her less so I could get high more. And I could never understand why I didn't want to be around her. And then I said, oh, she'll yell at me if I'm around her when I'm this messed up. But you know, it didn't jive in my head. I didn't quite understand why I was acting the way I was acting, but I couldn't do anything to change it. And it was almost scary for a while. And then my fiance got sick. She got something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is like a 9-month debilitating condition. You do recover from it, but it's a nervous system disorder that 1 in 100,000 people get. And she moved to LA to stay with her parents while she was sick. And it was just, oh, that, you know, opened the floodgates. You know, I had absolutely no controls on me anymore whatsoever when she moved out of town. And I've actually spoken to quite a few of the people that I lived with. It was a very small town in Oregon. I've spoken to quite a few people that I was friends with while I was there. And my one friend, Seth, he's actually said to me, he's like, you know, I loved you when you came. I loved you for the first couple of years you lived there. But after a while, I couldn't stand being around you. And, you know, now we're good friends again. And it's very interesting for me to reflect on that because I didn't see any difference in myself whatsoever at all. I didn't see that. When I went to the bar, I embarrassed myself and the people I was with. I didn't see that when I did do drugs, that it was never ending. It was a 2-week-long situation. It was not a one-time thing that I intended it to be when I started. And that's where what I think really differentiates an alcoholic from someone who drinks heavily is that you intend to do a certain way or you don't know exactly what's going to happen once you start. And it was really kind of scary, actually. I was afraid to drink after a while. I was afraid to go to the bars because I would intend to have a couple gin and tonics, and I'd end up there till 3 in the morning and have to be at work at 7 in the morning. And I'd show up at work still drunk. And at the time, I was blowing glass, and a 4,000-degree torch and drunkenness don't mix at all. the scars to prove it, too. I can actually remember getting made fun of, actually, by one of my coworkers, because he knew I was on something, but he didn't know what. He knew I was doing something very heavily, but he wasn't quite sure what. And I can remember him, you know, kind of joshing me for being out of control. And I mean, this is a guy who sold pounds of marijuana and drank on a daily basis. And I was getting, you know, joshed by him. And I said, how dare he? You know, the gall of that guy. And I wanted to kick his ass. I did. And I ended up leaving that, leaving the job I had and starting my own business. And it just seemed with each step of freedom I took, which actually felt like I was growing up, it was like a step backward in the using department. I ended up falling further and further into fear, depression, anger, the whole deal. With each step that I took forward, or it felt like taking forward, I would take three steps back, not just two. And I got sober again when I was got like 20 and change, and I stayed sober for a couple years, but I didn't do any work. I just kind of held the bar real tight, and it was while I was out west, and it was miserable, absolutely. I tried Prozac, I tried Wellbutrin, I tried all this different medication to fix me. I thought that that was what I needed to alleviate the pain and misery I was in, because I couldn't understand it. I was like, I'm a happy guy, you know, I wasn't raised in a bad home. You know, my dad quit drinking when I was 2, I couldn't blame it on that. I would have loved to. If my dad had drank till I was 5 or 6, I could have just blamed it all on him, and it would have been a perfect out, but I couldn't. I tried to blame it on my mom, you know, she was pretty good. My stepfather, hardworking guy from Brooklyn, I couldn't blame it on him. Tried to blame it on my sisters, nope, nothing there. My grandma became a scapegoat for a little bit of it. I was like, oh, she was an enabler. You know, she was giving me a place to stay when I needed it, or, you know, always hooked me up with an extra $100 if I needed it. That didn't fly too far either, even in my sick, depraved, manipulative mind. She, I lost my train of thought. But anyway, I ended up using again while I was out west. I was, I thought it was okay to use if I had a marijuana prescription, and that led me right back to alcohol. With the marijuana prescription, I was like, oh, it's legal, it's okay. And that just led me right back into the depravity and the insanity of using every day. And I developed a bad enough habit that I was actually afraid to be in the town I was in anymore. And it was time to move back East Coast because I had family here. My mother actually came to visit me right before I moved back, and I have pictures of it. And I recently showed those pictures to my girlfriend, and she was almost in tears. And I don't see any, you know, for a long time I didn't even look at them. I didn't see any difference between myself then and now. And just, I think it was yesterday, I looked at them again, and it's just insane how sick I looked. And my face was drawn, my eyes were sunken. And I thought I was healthy, and I thought I was doing great. I had just climbed a 13,000-foot peak a month before that. But it was the drugs and alcohol that were just tearing the life out of me. Well, I came back to New Jersey, and through this whole thing, I had been to jail a few times over numerous arrests. I didn't really elaborate on this. I skipped a couple things, too, but nothing real important. This one arrest is real important, though, that's coming up. So, I came back to New Jersey, and again, it was a non-conference approved substance that got me into AA this time. So it was, I was arrested in Elizabeth, New Jersey with 65 bags of heroin about a year ago. And it's not cool to get arrested in Elizabeth with 65 bags. It's not cool to get arrested anywhere with that. But in Elizabeth particular, because it's Union County, and they're very tough. And I was actually sentenced to, originally I was sentenced to 12 years in prison. And obviously I'm not in prison. I managed to get bailed out by manipulating my way into that one. Buddies of mine that had owed me money over the years called in favors and debts and threatened people and did whatever I had to do to get out. And I got out and I hired a lawyer. And my sentence actually ended up being a year in a halfway house, which I'm actually done with 6 months later, which is kind of interesting. And graduated from and out on all good terms. But it was a very good thing. I went to the Flynn House in Elizabeth. I know a couple guys in here have been there. And it was a very interesting place for me to really start working the steps. And I met my sponsor in an interesting way, who's Jameson right here. He said if I didn't mention him, I was in for an ass whooping after the meeting. So there you go, Jameson. All right. It's all your fault. I was in the Flynn House in Elizabeth, and it was a great place when I first got there. I was like, oh, wow, you know, I'm not in jail anymore. I did, I think, like 4 or 5 months in jail and a jail-sanctioned rehab. Actually, in the jail-sanctioned rehab, I knew I had to change something, and I started running a big book meeting there every Tuesday. And I didn't know anything, and, you know, I just knew some excerpts out of the big book from years around AA. And I would sit down with these other bunch of sickos, and we'd read out of the big book, and we'd share how sick we were. And then we'd laugh and make fun of each other and call it a meeting. So the Serenity Prayer at the beginning and Lord's Prayer at the end. We all felt real good about it because we didn't have to go to the mandatory meetings at night, where outside speakers came in with a little bit of a message. So tried to avoid that at all costs. When I got out of there, I went into this halfway house, and it was great at first because I was like, ooh, you know, I'm working, you know, I'm able to drive, I'm out, you know, I don't have to be in jail anymore. And I met Jameson in an interesting way. I actually asked this guy, John, to sponsor me at a meeting in Elizabeth. I went to meetings there every day for 3-4 weeks before I had heard anyone even mention the big book, which, if you know, anyone wants to go speak in Elizabeth. they need big book speakers. But I asked John to sponsor me, and as it turned out, he was moving to New York City real soon. And with my living situation and his situation, it wasn't going to work out. So I was turned on to Jameson. It was actually your roommate, I think, at the time, right? And Jameson and I started talking on the phone, and I met him, and my powerlessness was pretty obvious when we sat down to talk about it. I think we kind of even hit that on the phone. I knew that once I used, I couldn't stop, and I knew once I couldn't stop, it got real bad. And that was, my first step was pretty easy because of my experience. Not necessarily easy. It was easy to recognize the powerlessness and the uncontrollability that I had. And the unmanageability of my life was glaring me in the face because I was in a halfway house having just gotten out of jail, my fourth time in jail. And, you know, I'm 25 now. I was just after I turned 24 then, or 25 then. I'll be 26 in 3 weeks. Woo. But the unmanageability was definitely glaring me in the face. And the second step was a little tougher for me. I came to believe in a higher power. I can remember Jameson was like, just, you know, kind of meditate, pray on things. And I can remember saying to him, I feel like I'm praying to nothing. And he said, well, good, because nothing's going to run in your life better than you were. And it's one of my favorite things to say to new guys now. I love that. But he's right, because when I had my will, it was like a jet airplane just aimed straight at the ground. There was no whims about it. It was, and I was going to crash and burn when I run on my will, and that's the bottom line. And, oh, and don't get me wrong, I love to take it back once in a while, more than once in a while. But I'm conscious of that today. I'm not just flying blind. And so if I do end up pointing right at the ground or at a mountain, I know what's going on, and I can kind of do something to correct that. My third step, we did it in your apartment in Jersey City, and I'm not about the whole get on your knees thing. It's kind of weird for me. I was raised half Jewish, half Lutheran. The whole conflict there kind of makes me feel uncomfortable about getting on my knees. So I do my prayer in other weird positions. But Jameson from my... Carrie. I was told to get on my knees, and Jameson made me hold his hands. And that made me even more uncomfortable. And he put a big book out on the floor and pointed out the third step prayer. And right before we did it, he said, you know why I like to make new guys do it this way? And I said, no, why? And he said, because it makes them uncomfortable. And it was right. It took me right out of myself. And it really kind of shown me. It was a decision I made. It was a decision I made to stop the bullshit and stop running on my will. And start to run on something else's will, regardless of what that may be at the time. It was just start to run on something else's will, which is now my higher power, and I recognize that. But at the time, it was just kind of like, from my religious upbringing, I had a definite idea of God as a big angry guy with a big white beard in the sky, and he was going to punish me when I did wrong, and that doesn't work for me today. That doesn't work for me today at all. What works for me today is the idea of a loving higher power, a lot more spiritual aspect of it rather than a religious. Because still now, I don't particularly jive on religion. I don't think it's, you know, serious religion. I don't jive on a lot of the ways that God is presented in those religions. Some of them I do agree with, but most of them I don't. So I had to come up with my own concept that's completely original to work for me. And I'd imagine that just about everyone in the room had to do that. That's done a third step. It was quite enlightening to sit down and think about it and really really evaluate. And it was kind of neat because I kind of got to decide what I wanted my higher power to be. I kind of got to like just kind of formulate it in my head and go, well, that sounds kind of good. Yeah, I'll go with that. And I did, and it's working so far. So I'm not going to stop. When I started my fourth step, I did it straight out of the big book, traditional style, four columns. And the first column was a blast. I loved it. I wrote down all the people I was pissed at. And, it was great. It was like I'm pissed at him. I walked around with a pad for a couple weeks. A couple weeks, right? And I had 85 resentments, something like that. It was some good stuff. And my second column, that was a blast too. I loved it. I was like, because I got to rehash all the resentments that I went through the first time when I wrote their names. I got to, oh, I'm pissed at him because of this. I wrote it all down. And I was like, yeah. And I was filled with anger and rage. It was great. The third column, that got a little weird, you know, cause starting to look at what it affected in me. And I wasn't too down with that because it was all their fault. It had nothing to do with me at all. I was angry at this guy from when I was 5 years old because he stole my G.I. Joe, and damn it, it was all his fault. It had nothing to do with me. my third column was I did the extended third column for my fourth step, where I actually wrote out exactly what it affected me and why, and either my self-esteem or my personal relations, sex relations, pride. And once I started to really look at myself, it ceased being fun and started being healthy. And that was a good step to take in the fourth step. And the fourth column was where I really started to work, when I really looked at where... Now, I can actually remember sitting in the car with someone in AA, and they asked me... I was just in between my third and fourth column. They asked me if I had any personal defects. And I said, of course not. And he goes, wait a week. You'll have a couple. And I got to my fourth column, and I realized I did have a few. And it was a real bummer for me, because I was flying high. And I went through my fourth column, and it really is neat how that exercise alleviates the resentment. And I actually just took a guy, I'll get to the 12 step later, but there's a guy that I know who's working on his fourth step. He's on the second column, and he was talking to me about how much he hates this person for whatever reason. I can't remember why. And I sat down with him, and I went through the four columns with him. And at the end of it, he just kind of had this relaxed look on his face. And it was really neat. I was like, that worked for you, huh? And he was like, yeah, it's amazing. I'm going to go do it all right now. And he has like 100-plus resentments on his list. And I was like, you know, calm down. Talk to your sponsor about it. But it was really neat just to see it work in someone else. Having known that it worked in me, I thought, of course, being an alcoholic, I was like, oh, it only works for me, no one else. You know, because that's how our minds work. But seeing it work in him was really neat. It was, I think it was better for me than it was for him, actually, in that aspect. When I got to my fifth step, or when I was finished with my fourth step, we did my fifth step. I went to Central Park, sat on a blanket, and went through the whole shebang, all 85 resentments, I think like four fears, and an uneventful sex inventory. We've heard that at this podium before. You want me to? All right. There were lots of women that I was pissed at myself for not being more assertive with my selfishness with. Okay? No problem, Mike. Well, I went through everything. I went through everything with my sponsor, and I can remember a few distinct things that day. Actually, I forgot to even go over fears and sex. We did a fears inventory and four columns, and then a sex inventory where I listed everyone I had been involved with, either wanting to be involved with, not involved with, you know, whatever the case may be. Wrote it all down, wrote where I had possibly wronged them, and the whole shebang. But I went through it with my sponsor, and I can remember when I was done, I told my deepest, darkest secret to someone for the first time. And he goes, "That's it?" And I said, "Yeah." And he's like, he goes, I have a year plus sober, and you're where I was, and you're just starting out, and you're as healthy as I am right now." Well, and then we went to a diner, and I was asked if I was lying about anything, and I said, "No, why, you know, why would I lie about this?" And he said, "Well, you're alcoholic. We all lie." And I said, "Yeah, you know, you're right." And then he goes, "You look like you're lying." And I said, "Well, I'm not lying." And you know, I had to think for a minute, sat back, and I was like, "No, no, there's nothing." And he's like, "Remember, when you do this to a new guy, you have to ask him that at the end, because otherwise he'll pull a fast one on you." Well, immediately after we did my fifth, we went over 6 and 7, and for that moment, I'd say I was willing to have God remove my defects of character, but I've definitely snatched it back a few times. I still like to, like, actually consciously sometimes I'll be at work or something like that, and I'll find myself being selfish or, you know, whatever the case may be, and I'll intentionally not pray about something. I'll refuse to, you know, meditate on it or think about it because I want to hold on to it because I'm enjoying it at that moment. And it's strange with me. Things have to get painful before I really want to move on them. And I think that's the case with a lot of alcoholics. For my my eighth step, I kind of did it not exactly as I should have, I guess. I made a list of all the easy amends I had. and I had to go back and revise that after a couple weeks. But I've started my amends. I have some interesting stories from those. My first amends was to my mother. It was, I was actually very fearful to make amends to her, and I don't understand why, because my mother is a caring, loving woman that really held nothing against me. She, you know, she was married to an alcoholic for 10 years who is now sober 23 years. She understands that it's a disease. She understands that I suffer from it. She understands all these things, and I was still fearful to approach her on it. And I approached her. We went out to dinner, and we sat in her car somewhere, I think in the parking lot of a mall. And I made my amends to her. You know, I apologized for what I thought I had done. I asked her if there were any harms I had done that I didn't realize, and there was some serious stuff that I had never even considered that I had done. Stuff that I just totally blew off when I made the list of things that I had done to harm her. And it was amazing to me that I had affected my sisters and stepfather that much, because I can actually remember when I was a kid, like 15, 16 years old, I really do believe that it was my alcoholism making me feel that way. I kind of felt like I was sticking out from the family, you know, like I was never actually a part of my family. And through that, I don't know whether I was rationalizing or what the case is, but through that I always felt that what I did didn't affect them, didn't affect my sisters, didn't affect my stepfather, didn't affect my father. And truly, today, I think the only person that was least affected by it was my father, because being around AA, he was able to look at me and say, you know, there's nothing I can do to change what he's doing, and he's to run his course. God help him if he dies, but, you know, if not, you know, I can, you know, then we could have a relationship. But he knew that while I was off and running, that it just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to be healthy. It wasn't going to be good, because I was going to lie, cheat, steal, and be real selfish. I actually joke around a lot today. I call myself a professional selfish person. And it's true. You know, it's amazing how selfish we can be. It is, as an alcoholic. You don't even consider. You know, it doesn't even cross your mind. It's not like, I always thought that to be selfish, you had to really think on it. You had to be, oh, I'm going to be selfish now. I'm going to only think about myself. It's phenomenal how I can go about my day and do my nightly review, not even realize that I was selfish, and 3 days later realize that I was completely not considering someone else, completely stepping on their toes, you know, not picking up their clues at all, you know, the clues they were giving me when it was happening. It's amazing how my brain works, or our brains work like that. There's like a force field over it, and I can't see it. I can't see it until after the fact. And that really sucks because, you know, it's a lot harder to make amends on stuff 3 days after the fact than right there. It's a lot harder to, oh, sorry I yelled, you know, or sorry I did that. When you come back to someone 4 days later and say, oh, remember that spaghetti lunch we had on Tuesday? You know, I was real selfish about, you know, where we were going to eat. Or I lied to you about this, or whatever the case may be. It's a lot tougher to do that a few days later, I'm finding. My second amends I tried to make to my dad, and those I was least fearful of, that was one of the least fearful amends I had to make. And it's actually turned out to be the hardest, because he's in the program, and within 15 seconds of me sitting down to talk with him, he's like, you're making amends to me, aren't you? And I said, yeah, Dad, that's what I'm doing. He's like, well, I'm too damn tired right now. Let's do it another time. Yeah. He is a prick sometimes, yes. Oh, I'll let him listen to it. I don't care. I've tried to make amends to him now five times. And every time it's I'm too tired or this, that, or the other thing. And I'm realizing that I might be pushing too hard on that one. And he might not be ready to hear it. His life might be too crazy. But I got some good advice from a friend the other day that said I should just kind of sit him down for 30 seconds, because that may be what his attention span is right now, and say, I want to make amends to you. You know, if you're not ready to hear it, that's cool. You know, and just kind of be real. Tell him what my intentions are, be real honest with him, and go from there, see what he says, you know, work on it like that. I made amends to a friend of mine, Leanne, and I had been friends with her since I worked in that flower shop when I was 14. She's about 15 years older than me. We've always been real, really just good friends. We used to play chess together, watch The Simpsons, and used to smoke weed together when I was in high school and stuff. She is not one of us, but very cool lady, and who I'm actually still friends with. But I had abused her trust very often in my active days, asking her to cash checks from people I had stole them from. Just put her in very weird situations like that, borrowed money, taking a long time to return it. But the worst thing I really did was I was high around her kids, and I was drunk around her kids, and I brought drugs and alcohol into her home with, and I don't just mean pot, I mean, you know, more intense drugs, around a now 15 and 13-year-old, but was much younger. And she found out about all this stuff when I was in jail the last time. She heard my grandmother speak, and she found out about all of it, and I was just absolutely certain she never wanted to see me again. Absolutely certain of it. And it actually disappointed me quite a lot, because she's an excellent lady. She really is. And when I called her, she was really happy to hear from me. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't understand how she could have forgiven me when I wouldn't have forgiven me in that case. And I showed up at her house, and I was still, even though she sounded good on the phone, I was still expecting to get the door slammed in my face. And I didn't, and I was invited in, and I was given brownies that she made specially because she knew I was coming over. And not pot brownies, Kathy. And she made me tea, and we sat and talked, and I apologized for what I had done, and I asked her if there was anything I had done that I didn't realize, and she said no. And I was amazed at that, because I really thought there was probably a ton of stuff that I had done that I didn't realize to her. And she basically just said, I forgive you, you know, for all that you've done, but if you do it again, I'll castrate you. And that was coming from a place of love, despite how it sounds. That really was. It really blew my mind how she was that forgiving, because I don't think I could be that forgiving. You know, I think if I had done, or I had someone do to me what I did to her, I don't think that would fly. Financial amends are one of the toughest for me. I always feel like I'm not making enough money to go rock climbing enough, it's strange how I look at my financial situation and I'll say, oh, I can afford to spend $100 on this fun thing, but I can't afford to spend $20 on this amends. It's glaring selfishness, but it's something I'm working on. Enough on the nice stuff. I spoke for like 10 minutes on that. And there's a couple of men's I'm real fearful of that I'm holding off on, and I just need to do them. I want to share that out in front of my home group because you guys should bug me about them. There's two actually that I need to make, that I know I need to make because I feel it, and I'm not. And Mike, I figured which one that was you were talking about. And one's got a time limit on it actually, because a friend of mine's moving to England to go to Oxford, and I owe him a good amount of money, and he's an active alcoholic heroin addict, and I've been using that as an excuse not to get in contact with him. I've been using a number of things not to get in contact with him, but I've gotten a number of fabulous suggestions on how to deal with it, and haven't moved on it yet, but I'm getting there. That's what's most important I'm finding, is to stay in motion, because I have found myself stagnant certain times where I'll get lax on some things, and I don't know who said it. I think Mike, you might have, but it's a lot harder to get going on something once you stop than to keep going at it. And it really is. even with something simple like my nightly review, it takes 10 minutes at night. If I get lax on it for a couple days, that third day, it feels like work. Whereas if I just kept doing it, I'm actually looking forward to it. It's just my state of mind towards it, and I don't quite understand why or how that works, but that's the way it does work. Moving on to the 10th step. I like the 10th step because it's instant. You know, it's not real waiting with it. It's I did that, okay. You know, I need to fix that wrong right there. I need to work on that. It pops up all day long, every day. Dealing with my girlfriend, my parents, whomever. The only time I find that I have a hard time working it is my girlfriend has a 2-year-old, and it's tough to explain to a 2-year-old why you acted a certain way a couple hours ago or whatever. They don't quite get it. But the thought and energy is there on my part. And that's what's most important, I think. You know, if I do notice myself doing something where my character defects are glaring, I need to hop on it. It's a powerful step. It's all day long. It's there with me, all day while I'm working, while I'm playing, while I'm doing whatever. It shows itself. And if I'm not on top of those things, I can get real sick real fast, because a little thing here and a little thing there will add up to a big thing next week. It really will. My 11th step, I struggle terribly with my morning meditation. I really do. I have a tough time with it. Someone I know told me that just doing nightly review without the morning meditation is half measures. And what did they avail us? Nothing. It's tough for me in the morning. I end up going crazy because I'm one of those people who like to need to be somewhere at 7 o'clock, wake up at 6:59, poop, shower, shave, eat breakfast, call a couple friends, go to the bank, get coffee, and then be there on time. That doesn't work, and I'm like half hour late every time. It's just real tough for me in the morning. I can remember, I actually asked my sponsor this. I said, is it all right if I do it in the car on the way to work? He said, no, not on a regular basis, but once in a while, that's okay. It was just me trying to work my way out of doing it. It's interesting how I'll have time to do yoga in the morning, but I won't have time to do my morning meditation. I can't combine the two either. That's against the rules. I'm not quite sure who told me that, but why? Because I'm concentrating too much on deep breathing and stretching. Well, I'll ask you next time, Chris. Now, the 12th step. I've been having a rough time with that because every new guy I approach, he likes to use. He likes to go drink. I was told I'd kill my first five, and I'm on like number 9. and they're still going out. So I don't blame myself though, because I know I'm doing it to help me. And it's just real tough to have the motivation to keep doing it. I find myself not wanting to go to those crappy meetings around my house, not wanting to go. I hate to say it, but Adam said it last week, so I'll say it again. Dark tunnel AA. And because it's painful for me to sit through those meetings. It really is. Because the reason I like to think of them as dark tunnels is because there's no light and no hope. And it just turns me off. But I keep getting told that I need to carry the message to those places. You know, if you keep going to meetings that you like, and you keep going to meetings where everyone seems to be working the steps, you're just going to be telling people what they've already heard. You know, you're going to be telling people what they already know. And it's the new guy you got to grab, the guy that doesn't know anything, or girl, depending on your gender. And you got to sit down with them and start working the steps they were working with me. Because I was given quite a gift to go from where I was to where I'm at, you know, where I have a good job. I get paid decently. So I still feel I'm underpaid. But I live a happy life. I'm actually going to go get those last 6 credits, so my degree is official, even though I have the paper. I'm actually completing things in my life today instead of just half-assing them until it was enough to get by, which was a habit of mine all my life. My personal relationships are getting much more deep and rewarding, I'll say. I can contribute that to a couple things. One, most of my friends when I was using were people I either used with or sold to. And those people don't make good friends. They really don't. Because they'll rob you blind in a heartbeat. And now I don't want anything from the people I'm hanging around with. It's not like I'm trying to take something from them. It's I'm there because I enjoy their company. It's a huge difference, and it's something I didn't start to see until real recently, that with friendships and personal relationships, that I'm not out to get anything anymore. I'm out to enjoy someone's company. I'm about enjoying conversating with them, and simple pleasures like that have become so great and profound. It's amazing, what just that slight change will do. I wanted to talk about the 12 step a little more. It's I really always felt that the only way to truly learn something is to teach it. The only way to truly envelop something into yourself is to teach it to someone else. Whether it be when I was blowing glass or you know, sports, you know, climbing, whatever. I've never felt that I have truly known something until I could teach it to someone else. Because once I can teach it to someone else and make them grasp what I understand, then I truly do understand it. I know within myself that I understand it fully. And it's to understand the steps on that level is something I'd like, you know, to be able to take a guy all the way through and really understand all 12 steps on that level. And not that I really think that the way I think about them would change or anything like that, but to truly, I'll use a word, to digest them on that level, I think is very powerful. To digest anything on that level is powerful, but to digest a spiritual program such as this on that level is amazing. To be able to take something that changed my life and then actually almost study it, I'd say, working with someone to internalize the 12 steps and really, really take it into me. A couple more things about how my life is today, and I'll shut up. I'm currently dating a girl who I dated 6 years ago while I was using, and that was very interesting for me to hear where I had changed, because I couldn't see it. I honestly couldn't when I first started going out with her. I didn't even think there was any difference. And my mother would say this, and you know how mothers are. They're always complimenting you, no matter what you're doing. unless you're stealing from them. then they don't compliment you. But it was really amazing for me to get back with this girl and hear where I had changed my behaviors, where she'd say, you know, that never would have happened, you know, a couple years ago. That you never would have done that. And I would say, why? That feels natural. You know, it feels like I'm supposed to be doing that right now. But whatever the case may be, offer to take, you know, this out or that out or do this chore, whatever the case, you know, nothing major. But just the fact that I never would have even considered it in my past. I never would have crossed my mind because I was so enveloped in my own crap. Just to peek my eyes out above that and be able to see someone else's needs for the first time is pretty amazing. It's interesting, to say the least. Today I don't fear the cops anymore. That was a huge fear of mine for a lot of years. Anytime I saw a policeman, I'd instantly turn the corner or look over my shoulder, my rear view, and it's just a relief to not have to do that anymore. It's a relief to know that I'm not going to jail if I get pulled over. It's a relief to not have that stress in my life. It's a relief to not have to worry about going to a probation appointment and have to keep a bag of urine under my arm or any of those strange things I've done over the years to escape the consequences of my using. This is kind of funny, although it's a non-conference approved substance I'm talking about. I used to buy my neighbor's urine and keep it in a jar in the freezer to microwave for my probation appointments. And I never realized how psychotic that was until real recently. But man, that's pretty gross. You know, if you really think about it, yeah, it is gross. thanks for caring. But I think I'm drawing to a close. I hope you guys liked my little share, and that's it. Have a good night.